I am Plante on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the fall's highly readable books is Heenan Blakey, The Making and Unmaking of a Great Canadian Law Firm. It tells the story of how three idealistic young lawyers in Montreal established the firm that would become Heenan Blakey, Donald Johnston, Roy Heenan, and Peter Blakey. Eventually, Johnston leaves the firm for a career in politics, but from 1973 through to the firm's demise in 2014, the firm attracts a high profile with former prime ministers, premiers, cabinet ministers, and Supreme Court justices in its ranks. The book features great research and telling interviews with the firm's lawyers as well as legal industry insiders, providing an often gripping account of law firm culture, not just in Heenan Blakey's lifespan, but even today. We get insights into the work-life culture at the firm, as well as the stories of workplace bullying and the challenges for women and visible minority lawyers. What's also fascinating is how the growth of the firm mirrors the changes of Canada and how often history intersects with the firm's life. The 1970s oil shock, Quebec nationalism, the flight of business from Montreal to Toronto, the growth of film production, economic expansion in the 1980s and 90s, as well as the financial crisis of 2008. We see colorful characters amongst the firm, like its first big star, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, as he joins the firm once he leaves federal politics in 1984. Norman Bacall is another notable name in the firm's history, as are some other larger-than-life figures like Joe Groya, Bob Donaldson, and Marcelo Beau. The book's author, Adam Dodick, joins me now, and I'll ask him about the book and more. He is a professor in the Faculty of Law at the University of Ottawa, and among his numerous publications include In Search of the Ethical Lawyer, The Canadian Constitution, Third Edition, and Solicitor Client Privilege. He's a recipient of many awards, including the Mundell Medal for Excellence in Legal Writing and the Law Society Medal from the Law Society of Ontario. Visit adamdodick.ca for more. This new book is published by UBC Press. He joined me last week from Ottawa. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Adam Dodick. Professor Dodick, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. As I was telling you just before we started, how fascinating I found the book and the story about Heenan Blakey. There's such a mythology around this law firm. I mean, it's something that 10 years after its demise, people are still thinking about, still talking about. Did the this mythos going back to, say, when the law firm was founded with Roy Heenan, Peter Blakey, and Donald Johnston, the idea that it was founded on a handshake, I mean, the myths begin even at the start, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it was really, an old-school vision of how one conducts business based on trust that certainly by the early 70s had disappeared from much of business in Canada and I would say in North America. But these three men, idealistic, in their early 30s, were committed to building their firm, their company, based on trust and not based on any legal agreement. And that's surprising in and of itself, but what's perhaps even more surprising is that myth and that handshake and that lack of a legal agreement continued for almost three decades until 2002.
And it contributes to its demise too, doesn't it?
It does. In many things about Heenan Blakey, I say that its strength is also its weakness, or some of its strength is its kryptonite. And part of the appeal of Heenan Blakey was the lack of rigid structures that you would find at big organizations, whether it's sort of big business or government or academia. There weren't a lot of policies, and people were really free to pursue what they wanted to do. And they didn't need to do a detailed business plan for various things. But at the end of the day, when the firm ran into trouble in the 2010s, the early 2010s, they didn't have those policies and those structures to rely upon as sort of safety backups to help them out.
You write in the book about the culture of the law firm and contrast that to other law firms. You know, the Seven Sisters, as they're called. How were they viewed, the Heenan Blakey firm, by the other firms, say?
They were always viewed as different. In the book, I talk about this great satire that you can find on the internet that's called The Lawyer's Coloring Book. And every page says, color me gray. And that really defines much of Canadian and North American law firms, that most large law firms and most large organizations, whether they're banks or whether they're accounting firms or manufacturing firms, they look the same. And they're very small C, conservative. You don't want to stick out. But Ian Blakey was not like that at all. People dressed differently. Their offices looked different. And they were known as a different sort of law firm. They were known as the lifestyle law firm, not a grinded-out law firm where you build 2,000 hours, but a firm where you could do your work, go to work, have fun, and also have a life outside of the firm. And that was very different from most large law firms in Canada.
There's a line in the book about how... just in terms of the dress, it was casual Fridays throughout the week for a lot of people, right? One guy who wears a Hawaiian shirt all the time, right?
Yeah, there was a guy in Toronto who wore a Hawaiian shirt. They were casual, you know, before there were casual Fridays. And there was a guy who wore a T-shirt in Toronto because he was he had been in a punk rock band. In the 1980s, quite a well-known punk rock band. And, you know, it was a place where you didn't necessarily need to wear a tie or even a jacket. And again, that was very different in Toronto. Montreal was always a little bit more formal dress, only because fashion and dress in Montreal is a little bit more formal and more European mm-hmm. than, say, in Toronto or Vancouver or Calgary, but it was not a place that had a corporate uniform like most big law firms.
Well, what's fascinating is we see in the founders, and Donald Johnson leaves the firm, I guess that's in the late 70s, right? He goes into politics.
In 1978.
Yeah. We see how these three, and then later on the two, Heenan and Blakey, how they view the country. I mean, they have obviously political differences, but there's a certain idealism that's also indicative of Canada in the 1970s. As someone who's born in the 80s, I found that fascinating to read because there is a hangover in this country still about how the country was viewed then. And I guess both Heenan and Blakey embodied that, didn't they?
Yes, I think all three of them embodied it. Mm-hmm. They were men born in the post-war era, and they were Montrealers and they were Canadians, and they had a very broad vision of the practice of law. Again, it wasn't just doing work for your clients; it was being engaged in society, in your community, and being engaged in the political issues of the day. And in the 1970s in Montreal, the political issues of the day were the political issues of Canada. And Don Johnson was close with Pierre Trudeau and ultimately left Heenan Blakey, the firm he had founded as Johnston Heenan Blakey, left to run and win a seat for the Liberal Party in Montreal and join Pierre Trudeau's cabinet. And Peter Blakey was very involved in the Conservative Party, was a candidate for president. And Roy Heenan was involved in the arts. He was close with Trudeau. He was the head of the Trudeau Foundation for many years. So they had a model of and a vision of what it meant to be a lawyer that was very broad and that other people saw and other people, I don't know, imitated, but other people followed that example. And so you had a lot of people at Heenan Blakey who were very engaged with society in different ways. A lot of people that became judges, a lot of former politicians, a lot of people who did really, really interesting things beyond the sort of four corners of the law firm.
This brings us to another major character in the book, Norman Bacall. His experience as an Anglophone, as well as someone who is Jewish, says something about how a lot of Anglos and a lot of Jews felt in Montreal in those years after 1976. As we follow this character in the book, he moves to Toronto to set up the Heenan and Blakely office there. But, I mean, his experience, as I said, it says something about how a lot of people like him felt being in Montreal at that time, right?
Yes. There was a large exodus of Anglophones, especially Jewish Anglophones, from Montreal after the election of the Parti Québécois in 1976, and Ontario benefited from that. BC benefited from that, other regions of the country. And you had a further exodus after the failure of Meech Lake in 1990. Mm. And so Norm Bacall is part of that sort of second wave of exodus from Quebec of educated, talented, professional Anglophones. Norm Bacall is a lawyer. His wife was a partner at a big accounting firm. So we talk about brain drain sometimes to the U.S., sometimes other regions. They were part of the brain drain out of Quebec, the brain gain into Ontario that happened in the late 80s, early 90s out of Montreal and out of Quebec.
And do you think what it's like in Quebec today, Montreal especially, do you think it's overcome that even today?
I think you're still seeing some of the same dynamics of concern, especially you see it in medicine. Mm. You see it in universities. There's a lot of controversy over the English language universities in Quebec and over the loss of doctors in Quebec. So I think you're seeing, whether it's a third wave or another wave, you're seeing the same sorts of issues that have, I would say, plagued the province of Quebec since the early 1970s.
And how quickly did the Toronto office grow and eclipse, say, the Montreal office under Bacall's leadership there?
The Montreal office grew pretty quickly, but by its, by the standards of the time, three men, Johnson, Blakey, and Heenan, founded in 1973. By 1984, it has 39 lawyers, and the 40th, as I say, is a game changer, is Pierre Trudeau. Mm-hmm. But in Toronto, Norm Bacall founds the office with four other lawyers, the founding five, in Toronto in 1989. And within 6 or 7 years, they're up to 40 lawyers. And by the mid-2000s, they surpass Montreal. And there's a point in 2005, 2006 at one of the partners' meetings where the lawyers come from all across Canada to a meeting, and they were at Whistler or Mont-Tremblant because Roy loved to ski and Trudeau loved to ski, and so these big meetings were always at a ski resort. And they put up a slide, and every year they would put up a slide that said how many lawyers in every office, what new offices, how much office space, all these sort of statistics. And for the first time, the Toronto office is bigger than the Montreal office. And the Toronto partners start chanting, "Go Leafs, go." And that doesn't go over very well amongst the Montreal partners. I can't imagine that the Vancouver partners were particularly happy about that, or the Calgary partners.
Yeah.
But that's sort of symbolic of, a rivalry that had started to develop between Montreal and Toronto that led to some real tensions in those years just before the firm's collapse.
So the success of the Toronto firm is largely because of Bacall's tax unit. At the same time, as we read your book, it's also there's a, they're billing huge amounts. But eventually the tax laws change, do they? And then that's why there's a decline in revenue, especially with regards to the practice in Toronto?
Yeah, so there's no question that Norm Bacall made the Toronto office. By the time he left in Montreal in 1989, he was a young partner. He had he was bringing in the largest amount of business, even in Montreal, equivalent to Roy Heenan, and it was largely through these tax shelter deals involving the movie industry, something that's that folks in Vancouver are generally familiar with. And he had a great run. You know, this went on for about 20 years, and they would have been billing, 8, 10, $12 million a year from these tax shelter deals that were very lucrative. And then they were shut down by Minister of Finance Paul Martin in the, it'd be the early 2000s. And the firm had to pivot, and they found other business. Around the same time, a lawyer named Paul Rouleau, who some listeners will recognize the name because he was the judge who was appointed to review Justin Trudeau's government's invocation of the Emergencies Act in response to the trucker convoy. He was at Heenan Blakey only for 2 years, but he brought in a huge client, a generic drug manufacturer, Nova Farm, that was then bought out by Teva Pharmaceuticals. And they started bringing in $5, $6, $7, and then ultimately $8 to $12 million a year in billings, and became the biggest source of revenue in Toronto. So when Norm Bacall's big area of business started to shut down, this other area of business really opened up and flourished.
There are a number of colorful characters throughout the story. You mentioned Pierre Trudeau a moment ago, 1984, when he resigns as prime minister and joins Heenan Blakey. That really puts it on the map. And I mean, it's great PR, obviously, and a great get for a firm, any firm. But you compare what Trudeau brings as opposed to what Brian Mulroney brought to Ogilvy in the 1990s. I guess Mulroney is probably the better example of what a law firm would want, say, in a former prime minister, especially. I mean, Trudeau was great, a great ornament, I suppose, but in terms of the business itself, he didn't contribute very much, did he?
No, that's right. And I had the opportunity to review the Trudeau papers in the National Archives. And what was noticeable to me is there was a lot of correspondence from people who asked Trudeau if he would meet with their nephew or niece or son or daughter who was attending university in Montreal, or meet with a client to sign an autograph to take a picture. And Trudeau was very generous with that. But there were also letters asking Trudeau to consult on a case, and Trudeau almost always turned those down. Trudeau wasn't particularly interested in doing legal work. He did not bring in much in the way of clients or billings to the firm, and he didn't need the money. He was independently wealthy, and he didn't want the money. He had opportunities to give speeches around the world for $100,000, which was a lot of money at the time, $100,000 a speech, and he turned them down because he didn't want to be a sort of a gun for hire or a speech maker for hire. And so he, after a year at Heenan Blakey, he foregoed a salary and said he just wanted an office so that he could do whatever he wanted. Brian Mulroney, on the other hand, was a very different model. Brian Mulroney was what we call a rainmaker. He was a networker. He was very famous in politics for his Rolodex and his network. And he was a very hard worker at Ogilvy Renault and would work the phones, would go out for lunches and bring in clients and ask clients to hire Ogilvy Renault to do more work. And he was very profitable for the firm. And ultimately, Jean Chrétien joins Heenan Blakey after he steps down as prime minister. And he's much more in the model of Brian Mulroney in what he brought to Heenan Blakey than in the model of Jean Chrétien. Than the model of Pierre Trudeau. And Jean Chrétien was a very hard worker. I would see him Ottawa. He's 90 years old. He's still working here in Ottawa. But when he worked at Heenan Blakey, I would see him around town, wining and dining clients, potential clients. And so he brought in a lot of money for the Heenan Blakey law firm.
So the other colorful characters throughout the book, Joe Groya, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah.
Bob Donaldson and of course, Marcel Lobo, who a lot of people would recognize, say, from hockey or the Olympics. These are such larger-than-life characters, and you know, in many instances throughout each of their, say, 10 years at Heenan Blakey, you think they're going to turn things around or they're going to add something that you know, contributes to the growth, but eventually they all manage to because of multiple issues, sort of fizzle out and not really contribute much to the end. I guess you suppose that near the end of the book that perhaps Oboe could have weathered, say, the demise of Heenan Blakey, but not for very long, could he?
No, because I conclude that because he had probably the largest source of business and the largest following of anyone at Heenan Blakey, and he was respected by many of his partners, he potentially could have saved a remnant of Heenan Blakey. But his personality and his values were very different than those of Heenan Blakey. Nobody would ever call Marcel Lobo a kinder, gentler lawyer. He was rough. He was hard driving. He was selfish. He was arrogant. He had, you know, a collection of cars. He was a big spender, and he was somebody who was caught up ultimately in a sexual harassment scandal at the Canadian Olympic Committee a year after Heenan Blakey dissolved. And nobody who I spoke to who had worked at Heenan Blakey was surprised about that, because there were many people that witnessed and reported to me that they had seen similar sort of behavior at Heenan Blakey. Mm. So he could have saved the firm, but it would not have been the same Heenan Blakey. It would have been Heenan Oboe or Oboe Heenan, something like that.
Back to Heenan and Blakey themselves and how they work together. In terms of, say, managing a firm like this, their approach to solving problems, to managing conflicts, Heenan especially, how would you view that in terms of what happened to the firm eventually? I mean, if he were around more at the end there, do you think it would have been much different, a different story, say?
I'm not sure. I think that, I mean, both Roy Heenan and Peter Blakey were very, very strong personalities. They were also different personalities. Roy Heenan was the dreamer, the visionary. He didn't like details, and he didn't want to be sort of bogged down in details or a business plan. He just wanted to do things. So an example of that is how the Vancouver office was formed. Roy was at a conference with Peter Gall, a Vancouver lawyer, very well respected in terms of being a labor lawyer and a constitutional lawyer. And they're at this conference. Peter Gall was unhappy at his law firm, and Roy said, well, why don't you open an office of Heenan Blakey? And there was no business plan. There was no case for that. Roy comes back to Montreal from the conference, tells Peter Blakey, basically Peter Blakey says, you know, this isn't a request, right? This is a done deal, and that's basically how it was. Peter Blakey, on the other hand, was much more of a sort of rigorous details person. He had been he was the managing partner at Heenan Blakey for 20 years, while Roy was the chairman. So Roy got to deal with big strategic issues. Should we open a new line of business, a new practice group, a new office, whereas Peter dealt with the more sort of nuts and bolts. And when they clashed, it was a clash of equals. And that led to finding common ground. Peter left the firm to go into business in 1993, and from that point on, it was really Roy's firm. There was nobody that could tell Roy, we can't do something, we can't do this, we need to tone this down, etc. And Roy, you know, till the very end, had veto power at least over, if not control, over big decisions that the firm was making. And so there was no real counterweight to him, and that led to some problematic decisions like opening a Paris office, which turned out to be a huge failure for Heenan Blakey and a huge drain on their revenue as they lost hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not a million of dollars a year for 4 or 5 years.
So taking the perspective that you have, Adam, in writing this book with hindsight, you know, you look at how they founded the firm and then the 40 years or so that the firm was in business. I guess the thing I keep wondering about is that did either Heenan or Blakey or even Johnson, did they think that when they started this thing that it would last 100 years? I mean, did they have any idea to that at all as they were starting this?
I don't know about that. That's a great question. I think that they had been at previous firms, and I think that they knew that they were hoping to create something permanent. Whether that would last 100 years, I'm not sure, but they certainly had a plan to grow. They didn't want to remain a small law firm. I think they had dreams of becoming a big law firm, perhaps even outside of Quebec, where at that time in 1973, all law firms were local. There were BC law firms, Alberta law firms, Ontario, Montreal, Quebec, etc. Whether they had plans that their firm would outlast their lives, like Ogilvy Renault or some of these other, like Blake Castles, that predate Confederation, I'm not sure about that, but they certainly had a vision for growth and expansion and some degree, I would say, of permanency.
You talk in the book about diversity and inclusion and how Heenan Blakey tried to reflect the country. But as you write in the book, compared to other firms, in some respects it was better and in some worse. Would you talk to me about how they viewed diversity and inclusion might have contributed to its demise? I mean, is there a connection there, say?
I don't think there's necessarily a connection. I mean, there may be a bit of a connection in that women at Heenan Blakey, there were very few women in positions of power. And there were some exceptionally capable women who some people viewed as potential managing partners, and over the history of the firm, all of the managing partners, and of course the chairman for life was Roy Heenan, they were all men. And so there are a number of people that think that point to various capable women at Heenan Blakey and think they were strong leaders. Mm-hmm. Somebody like Marie-Josée Hogue, who is now heading up the inquiry into foreign interference in this country, in Ottawa. And she was a Heenan Blakey lifer. She started there just after law school, and she was there until the first week of January 2014. And people saw her as somebody who could have run the firm, would have been very capable. And when she left, people thought, well, if she's given up on the firm, you know, we're dead, we're in trouble. But women were not given the leadership opportunities that I think that they deserved at Heenan Blakey. And, you know, it's one of the many what ifs that if they had supported and mentored women in leadership positions, would the firm have done better? Would it have been able to survive? I don't know. So to me, that's the biggest connection to diversity and the collapse of the firm. But Heenan had a narrow vision of diversity that was consistent with the view of diversity of the time. So in the 1970s, its vision of diversity was English and French, bilingual, Anglophone and Francophone. that was very progressive for the time. Christian and Jews working in the same firm. Montreal is a very divided city along language and religious lines into the 1960s and the 1970s. So the idea that three Anglophones would found a firm, hire women right off the bat, three of the first 10 lawyers at Dean & Blakey were women, a number of Jewish lawyers were hired. That was unusual for the time, and it operated. These three Anglophones were all bilingual. Again, this is unusual in Montreal in 1973. It's before the rise of the Parti Québécois. It's before language laws in Quebec mandating the use of French. They were committed to a vision of Canada and of their law firm that saw English and French at the center, and they always operated in both English and French to the very end.
The sense, Adam, that I got as I was reading the book is that in the writing, you probably enjoyed that a great deal, did you? I mean, you mentioned going through the archives and looking at Trudeau's papers. I mean, I can't imagine how fun that would have been in terms of just research. Did you have fun writing this book?
This was a great project. It was a labor of love. I spent about 8 years on the project. I interviewed over 180 lawyers who had worked at Dean & Blakey sometime between 1973 and 2014, and another 40 to 50 lawyers and other people in the legal profession. People were so generous to me, and I learned so much in the time that I spent with them. So I really, really enjoyed the project, and I loved writing the book, and hopefully readers will enjoy it.
I enjoyed it a great deal. I noticed that in the acknowledgments you have a Heenan Blakey mug.
I do. That was a gift. Somebody gave that to me, who I didn't know before. And they said, here, we thought you might like this.
In preparing for our chat, I have a Peter Blakey button because I collect political buttons. And I meant to take a photo and post it online, but I can't seem to find it at the moment. But I do. I guess he was running for the Tory party presidency at one point, and so it's a button from that campaign.
But,
The other thing I enjoyed about your book a great deal is that you through various parts of the book, you mentioned what's going on in the rest of the world, the rest of the country, not just politically, but culturally. And I'm always curious to know, when I talk to someone who teaches law, about what their favorite depictions of a lawyer or a judge are, say, in film and TV. Have you got any that stand out for you that you like, say?
Absolutely. I mean, I grew up watching Perry Mason. Mm. I loved Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy.
Yeah.
And then law started to come into TV when I was growing up in Vancouver in the 1980s, and there was a show, first show really about a law firm that was called L.A. Law, and for some reason it's never been streamed, it's not on DVD, but it was the first show about a law firm. And then I really, really like Legally Blonde. Mm. And the reason I like Legally Blonde is because I really identify with the main character, Elle Woods, who was a blonde fashion major at Harvard Law School, and I was a Canadian from Vancouver at Harvard Law School, and I wasn't invited to all the cool things in the way that Elle Woods wasn't invited.
Yeah.
So she's one of my heroes that I love talking about with my students.
The other one that I hear a lot about, and I would like to finish one day, is, it just slipped my mind, the John Houseman movie that became a TV show. Paper Chase.
The Paper Chase, yes.
I've always wondered whether that was accurate, say.
I think there was a lot of accuracy in that. And that was, I think that was a movie from the 70s. Yeah. I attended Harvard Law School in the early 90s. There's still a remnant of that.
Mm.
You know, there's a famous line in the movie where Harvard, even when I was attending, I think it was very Socratic questioning. You're called upon without without any preparation. So I'd be called upon, Mr. Dodek, please tell us about this case. And in the movie, the main character is not prepared to answer. He doesn't know the answer. And the professor says, you know, Mr. Dodek, here is a dime. Go call your mother and tell him that you will not be becoming a lawyer. And, you know, there were professors that would, still in my time, would act not quite that abusive or sarcastic, but sometimes close to that,
As I said, I enjoyed the book a great deal, and I enjoyed our chat today. Congratulations on this book, Adam, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your interest in the book.
The website for more is at adamdodek.ca. The book is called Heenan Blakey, The Making and Unmaking of a Great Canadian Law Firm. It's published by UBC Press. Its author, Adam Dodek, joined me on the line from Ottawa. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.